I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me an opportunity to talk about the work we did at the National Research Council in Canada. I'd like to start off by acknowledging my co-authors. Abed, Corey, and Brandon were co-op students, undergraduate co-op students at the time of the experiment. So it's not bad getting a Nature publication out of a co-op term. Jeff Lundeen is the guy who should get credit for the concept behind this experiment. He's a colleague at NRC. And this work was published about 2 months ago. That's a reference if you want to look it up. Okay, so this will be the outline of my talk. I'm going to try and motivate things by talking about how experimentalists and theorists look at the what the wave function means differently. And then I'm going to get into a description of how we actually measure the wave function, and I'm going to try and give you an intuitive picture of what's going on. The idea is that we're going to take the wave function and we're going to tweak one part of that. And that part that we tweak is the part that we're going to measure. We're going to tweak it in such a way that it's different from the rest of the wave function, and we can build a measurement apparatus that can filter out that part of it. So after this intuitive picture, I'll actually go into the mathematical formalism behind the experiment, and then I'll present some experimental results where we've taken one example of a quantum wave function, in this case, the transverse wave function of a single photon, and measured it. And if there's time, I'd like to, just for fun, try and reinterpret this experiment in terms of classical theory. Okay, so this is a simplistic view, but I'm going to characterize the activities of experimentalists and theorists as being parallel, similar in some ways, but different in other ways. So an experimentalist prepares the experiment. He sets up a set of initial conditions to define what's going to be measured. And he can pass that prescription to a theorist, and the theorist can theoretically develop a model that should encapsulate all the information of that those initial conditions, and this could be based on boundary conditions or the initial conditions. Anyway, he theoretically calculates the wave function, and the wave function is supposed to encapsulate all the information that's known about the system. The experimentalist goes on and starts the experiment up and lets the system evolve to a state where he's ready to make a measurement. Now the theorist does something similar, except he does it computationally. He lets that wave function evolve according to the appropriate wave equation for the type of particle that's being measured. Finally, the experimentalist makes a measurement of a real observable of the system, and a theorist, after that wave function has evolved, he can, using the Born rule, he can predict the results of this measurement. And in general, quantum mechanics works because what the experimentalists measure and what the theorists measure tend to agree with each other. The problem being that it's really the realm of the theorists where the wave function has the most importance. And in the early days of quantum mechanics, there was a lot of philosophical discussion about what the wave function meant, whether it was an ultimate description of true reality, and that those kind of conversations or discussions were largely quelled with the Copenhagen interpretation, which says, if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. It's not a real thing. But experimentalists have found a way to get to the wave function, and it's kind of a backdoor approach. It's called quantum state tomography. And in quantum state tomography, you take a series of measurements, and then you work backwards through the theory to the wave function and find a wave function that is most consistent with that set of measurements. And that's how the wave function has been measured up until now. So here's an example. This is an example of showing how the Wigner function is measured, but it's equivalent to the wave function for a series of squeeze states. And what is done is a local oscillator is beat against these phase states with varying phase, and you generate what is essentially a two-dimensional projection of the Wigner function. And then there's a complicated algorithm where you can take this data and calculate these shapes based on that. And there tends to be good agreement between what's expected and what's actually measured. But you got to ask the question, is there another way to do it? Wouldn't it be nice if you could measure the wave function directly? And that's the motivation behind this experiment, is to try and get a direct way of measuring the wave function that doesn't involve a lot of computation and assumptions about the form. So I'm going to introduce weak measurement theory a little bit differently than most people introduce it. And I want to start off with four concepts that I'll run through. The first one is, in the limit that you do nothing to a wave function, the wave function will evolve as if you did nothing to it, which doesn't sound like you're saying much, but the idea here is you can make small changes to the wave function, and they're not going to behave remarkably different from an unchanged wave function. The next idea is that you can tweak the wave function. You can make a small change to the wave function, and if you make the right kind of change, you can actually measure the effect of that change. So what we're going to do when we tweak the wave function is we're going to identify part of the wave function, and we're going to flag it in such a way that we can look at that part at a future time after something has happened to the wave function. Now, this is weak measurement theory, and we want to be able to control how much we tweak the wave function. So we want to be able to turn that down. We want to be able to decrease the magnitude with which we tweak the wave function to a point where this first statement is true, right? Where the wave function is not really behaving any differently than an untweaked wave function. And this is, again, in the limit. And finally, one problem with this technique is as you turn down the magnitude, your measurement precision is lost. So with any one particular particle, you don't learn a lot about the wave function of that particle. But if you repeat this with an ensemble of identical particles, you can restore that precision by averaging out the effects of the measurement. Okay, so how will we tweak the wave function? And I have a few criteria here which are supposed to give you an intuitive picture of what's important when you tweak the wave function. You want to be able to localize that change to the wave function. You want to be able to take one part of the wave function and make a tiny change to it, but a kind of change that you can measure at a future time. We want that tweak to be continuously variable in magnitude. We want to be able to turn it down to a point where it's weak enough that we're not really changing the wave function in a large way. The tweak has got to be measurable, and the tweak has got to be persistent. And what I mean by persistent is when you make a change to the wave function can continue to evolve, but the magnitude of that tweak is going to be constant through the time evolution. In the example I'm going to present later on, what we're going to do is we're actually going to use polarization, and we're going to rotate the polarization a little bit. But that's just one method of being able to make a small change to the wave function. Okay, so once you've tweaked the wave function, you want to be able to measure the effect of the tweak. So you need to build some sort of experimental system where you can take a wave function and you can separate it into the part that was tweaked and the rest of the wave function that was not tweaked. By the way, these are cartoons. These are not real wave functions. You probably recognize that. Anyway, if you're able to do that, you can measure an intensity in these two detectors, or if you're working with single particles, you can actually count the number of clicks that you get in one detector as opposed to the number of clicks that you get in the second detector. And what this tells you is it tells you the probability that the particle was at position X, X being the place where you made this small tweak to the wave function. And it's simply given by the magnitude of the signal in detector A divided by the sum of the magnitudes in detectors A and B. Okay, this does not give you the wave function. This gives you the wave function squared. It's not really what you want, but we will get to that as the talk progresses. Now, if you turn down the magnitude with which you tweak the wave function, You're no longer able to get a good discrimination between that part of the wave function that was tweaked and that part of the wave function that was not tweaked. But you can still make a measurement. You can build an analyzer where you take the signal in detector A and the signal in detector B and take the difference between those two signals. As you turn down the magnitude with which you're tweaking this wave function, those two signals are going to get closer and closer to being balanced. But as long as you make a small change, you will have some asymmetry that you're able to measure. In this instance, you no longer get an equality, you get a proportionality between the difference in the signal and the position, the probability that the particle went through position X. But if you measure this through all X's, you can determine the shape of that probability, and then simply all you have to do is normalize by an overall probability of 1, and you get the wave function squared. So this is one part that you have to understand and able to understand how we were able to measure the wave function. One thing I should point out is once the wave function is tweaked, it can evolve to a different form at a different time. And you're still able to extract the tweak, and the measurement that you made at this future time does not tell you about the wave function at this time. It tells you about the wave function when it was initially tweaked, right? So this is what I mean by persistence of the tweak that you make to the wave function. Now, for this to be true, the important thing is that the system be lossless. So as this wave function evolves from this state to this state, there's no loss in amplitude. There's no lost particles, okay? But it turns out that loss can actually be can be used to work to your advantage. And you can take some sort of wave function, pass it through some sort of lossy filter where you lose some of that wave function, and then when you measure the tweak in this state, which is known as the post-selected state, you're going to get a different answer. And that different answer that you get will depend on the form of the filter that you're using to throw away some of the particles. Okay, so we're getting close to the math part of the talk. So I'm going to talk about something that's called a weak value. And a weak value involves these three operations. Initially, we're going to tweak the wave function. After that, we're going to introduce some sort of loss, and this is the post-selection process where we throw away some of the signal, but we maintain the rest of the signal. And finally, we measure that component of the tweak, which gets through our filter. Okay. So mathematically, you can describe the weak value in this form. So what happens is you have an original wave function, and you act on that wave function with a measurement operator by tweaking it. So you at one local point of the wave function, you change it. But this modified wave function is then projected onto a post-selected state. So that's given by here. And then finally, there's a normalization, which is actually a pretty interesting term. You can increase the magnitude of the weak value if you have a small amount of overlap between your post-selected state and your original state. And this is known as amplification. Okay, so let's plug in some numbers to see how this works in practice. So we're going to start with a simple case where we're going to tweak on position, but we're going to have no post-selection. So our position operator is given here. It's just a projection onto positional space. Our post-selected operator is just the original operator. And if you plug that into the weak value formula, it looks like this. So this is the wave function projected onto position space. This is the complex conjugate. And it's divided by the square of the wave function integrated over all space. So this is just one. And these two terms are given by the wave function expressed as a position of x, complex conjugate, multiplied by the wave function itself, the wave function squared. So this was what I was talking about earlier in the talk, where when you have no post-selection, you're able to determine not the wave function itself, but the wave function squared. Okay, this is not what we did in the experiment. The nice thing about this is actually just the Born rule, right? This is telling us that the weak value of position is the same as what you would have gotten if you'd made a strong measurement of position. Okay, so for the next example, we're going to tweak the wave function. We're going to make a small change to it, position by position, but we're going to post-select in momentum space, and we're actually going to select one momentum value. So the momentum value we're going to choose is zero. So any momentum that is non-zero is going to be lost. What you can imagine is we would take the wave function, we would come up with a way to disperse it in momentum space, and then we could set up some sort of slit or aperture to block all those momenta that don't correspond to zero. If you do this and plug into the equation, what you get is, again, you get the wave function as a function of position, but the overlap between position and momentum, these are conjugate values, and it's just given by a term which has magnitude 1 and has got a phase in the complex plane. Okay. In your denominator, you've just got the wave function expressed in momentum space, but we're only looking at one particular momentum value. So by making a weak measurement, tweaking on position and post-selecting in momentum, what we get is a value which is proportional to the wave function itself. One thing I should have mentioned is, let me just get back here for a minute. This measure of the weak value is, in principle, a complex number, right? There's no reason that you would expect this to give you a real result. And so by making this set of measurements, we actually get a complex result. And the weak value of position is just some constant times the wave function itself. So this was the idea that Jeff came up with. This is the basic idea behind the experiment. And this is the kind of technique that we wanted to use when we measured the wave function. So now I'm going to move on to one example. The previous discussion is generally true for any quantum system, but because we have a quantum optics lab, we opted to try and demonstrate this looking at the transverse wave function of a photon. So let me just explain what I mean by the transverse wave function of a photon. As a photon propagates in the z direction, the transverse wave function is the form of the wave function in a direction perpendicular to that. Now, in principle, the transverse wave function is two-dimensional, but to simplify things, we measured it only in one dimension. Okay, we wanted to do this measurement with single photons, so let me take a few minutes to describe how we produce those single photons. We used spontaneous parametric down conversion. Probably a lot of you are familiar with this. We started with a pump pulse and sent it through a nonlinear crystal that had a non-zero chi 2. And we generated, we split that single photon into a pair of photons. One blue photon gave us two red photons with opposite polarizations. With a polarizing beam splitter, we could separate the two. A measurement of a photon in the heralding detector ensures that there's a photon traveling forward toward the experiment. So by making coincidence measurements between our heralding detector and our detector's future, further on in the experiment, we're able to ensure that we're working with single photons. We had a Thai sapphire laser. We actually started with the laser operating at 800 nanometers, and we initially went through a doubling crystal. Well, after some dispersion correction, we went through a doubling crystal to convert about half of that light to the blue. And we split off the red and dumped it into a beam dump. The blue traveled on and was focused down into our parametric down conversion crystal. And after a polarizing beam splitter, those two photons were separated. One went to the heralding detector and the other went on to the experiment. Now, initially, what we did is we, rather than sending the second photon on to the experiment, we had a separate detector. And we looked in coincidence space. So we were looking for coincidences between the detectors firing simultaneously. And when we dump the original red beam, there's a lot of scatter that goes on in the room. We spend a lot of time trying to suppress that as much as possible. But in general, every time the laser fires, you see a coincidence of a few hundred counts per second, which are just random coincidences, probably attributable to that dump beam. But there is one time bin where we saw a much greater amplitude in terms of correlations, and this corresponds to correlated photon pairs. So we had a background of a few hundred counts per second, and when everything was tweaked up, we were getting about a million heralded single photons per second. Okay, so I'm going to break the experiment down step by step so you can understand how it worked. We took those single photons and sent them through a single mode fiber, and when light travels in a single mode fiber, when it emerges from that fiber, it's going to look exactly the same for each photon that comes out. And so this is how we're able to ensure that we get an ensemble of identical photons, by using the single mode fiber. So light, when it comes out of that fiber, diverges. And in general, you expect a Gaussian mode to propagate. So the light propagated out from the fiber. We actually polarized the light shortly after it exited from the fiber. And then we wanted to collimate that light to form our initial wave function. The light that was coming from the fiber actually overfilled that optic. This was a 30 centimeter focal length lens that had a 50 millimeter diameter. So we would expect a Gaussian beam to come out, but because we're not capturing all of that light, the Gaussian that we expect to see should be truncated. The next step in the experiment is where we want to make that small change to the wave function, that small tweak. And because we had an initial polarizer, we were able to use polarization as the flag to tell us where we had actually made the change to the wave function. So we were able to use a small element, which was a half-wave plate, and a half-wave plate will give you a small rotation to the polarization. So let's imagine that you were looking toward the beam after it came through this 50 millimeter collimating lens. One thing we did was we had a rectangular mask. So we masked off the beam. So imagine you're looking into the beam, and the beam is originally polarized. We used a sliver, and as we stepped that sliver across the width of the beam, we induced a small polarization rotation of about 10 degrees step by step. So this would be one position, that we'd make a measurement. Then we would move on to the next position, make another measurement, and in this way, we were able to map out the wave function in one dimension across the width of the beam. And this is how we did it. This is looking backwards toward the original single mode fiber. It's behind this optic. This is our original polarizer. This is our collimating lens. And what's not shown here is we had a rectangular mask, so we only masked off the central portion of the lens. And this is actually our wave plate sliver that we used to induce that polarization. We took a wave plate and we had it cut up so it was one millimeter wide. And it's on the translation stage, so this steps step by step across the beam. And we're able to make that small tweak at each position. Okay, after we make that tweak, we want to make, we're calling it a strong measurement. This is actually the post-selection process. So by taking the beam and sending it through a lens, if we look at the one focal length away from that lens, we're in the Fourier transform plane. So what we've done is we've taken this transverse wave function, transverse in space, and we've converted it to transverse momentum. And in that plane, in that focal plane, we put a slit. And that slit blocked most of the beam. This is our selective loss process, where a lot of the beam gets thrown away, but the beam that gets through is only that part of the beam that has zero transverse momentum. And then finally, we have we used a standard technique for measuring the polarization change. So what we're measuring here is what was induced back here by the wave plate. But remember, all we're doing is we're using polarization to tag position to provide us with a flag of what position of the beam we're looking at each point. Okay, so we put all that together. With a half wave plate in, we would measure this polarizing beam splitter was set at the plus and minus 45 degree angle. So if there was no wave plate in, if there was no adjustment to the beam, you would expect the counts to be equally divided between these two detectors. But once the wave plate starts to enter, there's a slight asymmetry, and one detector should see higher counts than the other detector. And so we take the difference between the two and normalize it by the sum. And that gives us our signal. The real part of the wave function would be measured when we used a half wave plate. That gives us the in-phase polarization. But if we put a quarter wave plate in, we're working in a circular basis, and that gives us the in-quadrature polarization. So the in-phase polarization corresponds to the real part of the wave function. The in-quadrature polarization corresponds to the imaginary part of the wave function. So we went ahead and we made some measurements. And these were our initial measurement results. What's shown here is the blue. The blue is the real part of the wave function. And the red is the imaginary part of the wave function. And if you look at this data, initially, you might not be too impressed. It looks like we're measuring something systematic, but it looks noisy. It looks like there's something else going on. It doesn't really look like good data. And so initially, we were disappointed with this data. But this is the raw data. So we can actually calculate things from this data to see how well it conforms to the actual experiment. And what we calculated was the intensity. So if we square the real part and we square the imaginary part and add them together, we get the wave function squared. And that's given by these red points here. The black line here is an intensity scan. So in this case, we took a power meter and we put it in place of the sliver with a 1 millimeter aperture and scanned it across the beam, and we get very good agreement. This is our truncated Gaussian, and you don't see it here, but when you process the data, you see it here, and the agreement is good. The other thing you can do is you can take the inverse tan of the ratio of these two, and that gives you the phase. And this is what we measured here, right? So there is something systematic going on with the phase. There's a little bit of tilt. And what that tilt corresponds to is if our slit is not exactly on axis, if it's a little displaced, you would expect a linear gradient of a phase across the beam. But there's still this wiggle that originally we didn't understand. It turns out that that's the residual aberration in the lens we used, in the 30-centimeter collimating lens. We took that lens. It was supposed to be better than that. It's supposed to be a 20th wave lens, and it's actually about an 8th wave lens. So we measured that on a zygote. We got the same answer as we got here. And we called the company, and we purchased lab from the lens from 4 Labs. And originally, when they spec'd the lens, they spec'd it based on design and not on fabrication. So it turns out that the lens that we thought was going to be 20th wave is actually only an 8th wave. And since that time, 4 Labs has amended their website and corrected the good value, the specs of that lens to the correct value. So this is pretty interesting. We've actually measured the aberration in a optical element with single photons. Okay, so we wanted to convince ourselves that we really understood what was going on. So we made a number of modifications to the wave function to see if we would get good agreement. The first modification we made was in the intensity of the beam. We used what's known as a reverse bullseye filter. So this is that high transmission on axis, and then as you move off axis, it gets darker and darker. So we expected we would take our truncated Gaussian and narrow it down so that it would fit within the lens. I'm not showing the real and imaginary parts, I'm just showing the wave function squared. And you can see we got good agreement between our experimental data, the red error bars here, and again, another intensity scan using a power meter. So this looks good. The next thing we did was we wanted to look at phase, and we did the crudest thing possible. We took our beam, and we put a piece of glass of unknown thickness halfway across the beam. When you do that, you can make real and imaginary measurements, and you can see there's a discontinuity here. There's a large phase shift. But if you square these two and add them together, you are able to reproduce your this is again with the reverse bullseye filter. And we were able to reproduce the intensity or the wave function squared with the exception of one point on axis, which probably corresponded to scatter off the edge of that optic. We wanted to look at phase in different ways. And another way you can introduce controllable phase to the wave function is by tilting it with respect to your measurement apparatus. And so what I'm showing here are real and imaginary measurements as phase is increased from this position where we're closest to being on axis to larger and larger tilts. And what's given down here, we've taken the residual phase in the center position and we've subtracted that from everything else. So we're basically subtracting that lens aberration from everything else. And when you do that, you get nice linear phase gradients. And those phase gradients you can fit. And if you plot them against what you predict, you get very good agreement. So we're really convinced that we knew what we were doing. Next thing we did was we wanted to add phase curvature. We could do that by taking our collimating lens and translating it a little bit. And when you do that, you expect to get a curved wavefront. And when you measure it, when you measure the real and imaginary parts and take the arc tangent of the ratio, you get exactly what you expect. And the last thing we did was we removed the slit. So when you remove the slit, there's no post-selection, and you expect to get the wave function squared. You know, we went through the mathematics, and this is what we got. We got the wave function squared. The wave function squared corresponded to the real part of the measurement, and the imaginary part of the measurement was essentially zero. So we're really convinced that the data we're getting is very clean and it is a true representation of the wave function of the photon. Now this technique can be generalized to different basis sets. In our experiment we use position and momentum, but it turns out that you can use any two conjugate bases. These two bases, the requirement is that they should be mutually unbiased bases. And all that means is that if you have an eigenstate in one basis, you get a flat distribution in the opposite basis. And if you can come up with any two bases that behave in that way, you're able to express the wave function as a in terms of one of those basis sets. By making a weak measurement, by making this tweak in the one basis, and then making a post-selecting in the second basis at a specific value. So this is a generalized technique. We've shown it for photons, but it should apply to neutrons, electrons, whatever you want. The nice thing about this is it's direct. You know, we have not had to work through properties to determine, other measurements to calculate what the wave function should be. And this is really the most important part of the experiment. If someone were to ask you what a wave function is, the common consensus right now is that the wave function is an abstract element of quantum theory. And what we're proposing is that we can think of things a little bit differently. We could define the wave function if we wanted to by saying what is directly measured by scanning a weak measurement through a basis and then appropriately post-selecting on the conjugate basis. And so as a group of physicists, we have to decide whether there's value in making this change. And to my mind, there truly is. This takes the wave function from an abstract element to something that an experimentalist can actually measure and then pass on that information to the theoretician to calculate through the appropriate wave equation. So this is the most important part of the experiment. The last part of the talk, I just have a few minutes. Just for fun, I'm going to reinterpret this experiment in terms of classical physics. So we're going to travel back in time. So everyone, please remain in your seat, because we're going back to the year 1862. Okay, and in that year, Abraham Lincoln is president. Canada's not yet a country. Einstein's not going to be born for 17 years, so there's no quantum mechanics, right? And light is a wave in ether. There's no Michelson-Morley yet, okay? So the question is, can we still describe our experiment? And there should be a wave. I chose the year 1862 because this was the year that Maxwell published his equations, and this is kind of the crowning achievement of classical electrodynamics. So how would we look at this experiment from a classical viewpoint? There's light that's propagating toward our sliver, and we want to split that up into two parts, the light that goes around the sliver and the light that goes through the sliver. We've got the light that goes around the sliver has got a smaller F number, so it should be focused tighter, and the light that goes through the sliver has got a larger F number, and so it's going to be focused broader. But with the slit, we can just choose the two peak values of those two components and interfere them together. So what you can imagine is position by position, you can calculate a phasor diagram where you calculate the vector corresponding to the light that goes around the sliver and another vector at a slight angle corresponding to light that goes through the sliver. And then you look at intensities in these two detectors. And if you do that, what you end up is, with the half-wave played in, you measure something that's proportional to the real part of the electric field. And with a quarter-wave played in, you measure something that's proportional to the imaginary part of the electric field. And it turns out that this is actually a pretty interesting measurement, because we're actually measuring with the first optic, with that sliver out in front of the experiment. So, and these denominators, in the case where this overall vector is not really changing in length, are constant. So we've got a real proportionality. And one of the ideas that we're trying to suggest right now is that this technique by itself might be of interest to astronomers, because you can imagine taking a big telescope and putting something up front to create this tweak to the wavefront of the beam propagating toward the telescope, and you can actually create a telescope that would measure the phase front of light and not just the image. So this is kind of an aside. It's kind of a cool idea that just came out of a reinterpretation of the experiment. So I'm going to conclude by saying that we've demonstrated the direct measurement of the quantum wave function. We've proposed an operational definition of the wave function, and we need to decide whether this is something that we want to work with. And through a classical analysis of this technique, we may have discovered a new tool for wavefront measurements. Thank you.